Let's get right into it. Part one, delightful. This time we get into a little bit more of the existential elements of life and catching up with someone a few years after the first time you spoke with them, which podcasts, I think, allow you to do maybe more than, I mean, how frequently do you meet someone for the first time, have an hour-long plus conversation, and then catch up years later and go, oh, yeah, yeah, remind me what you were doing then? To me, it's atypical, and yet I like it. Cuts through all the nonsense of checking in with people constantly and what's the weather like? You don't really need that. You need to know how people are feeling, how they're doing, what they're up to. So here's a continuation with Yoichi Shiga. Back in, you just shared with me the link to Surcharge a lot. And you said you're kind of a sucker for, what was that? What was the thing that you are a sucker for?
I don't know, just like naming things. May not be good names, but I just like naming things.
I like it. I mean, that's such a... Someone tells your story. So we had an ER visit, and then a month or two later started getting this bill, similar to yours, like, you know, over $1,000, and being like, wait a second, like this was an ER visit. This should be covered. And so this is boring medical talk, but it's along the lines of like... what seems to be a problem that no one knows how to really narrow down or zero in on, which is calling insurance. And they're like, oh, well, there's a provider. Then there's the hospital itself. Then there's a medical group. Then there's your insurance. They all are trying to communicate with each other to like get this bill. So let me talk to them. You're covered. It's weird to hear an insurance company like, I'm trying to pay this for you. Let me. And they call and they wait on hold. You know, they don't have like a backdoor number. I'm giving them the 1-800 number. And they're like, okay, I'll call you back in a few hours after I've. And if you're working at a call center, that's got to be fun. I mean, that sounds ridiculous. But to just be on hold, you're like, I'm doing my own thing on the computer. And I'm just getting paid while I'm on hold here waiting. Someone picks up and they go, hey, here's this member ID number for this person. They had this service. What's going on? And then they trace it back. Oh, it was sent out to the wrong medical group. So then they call them. I mean, it just goes around in circles. But the base of it, or the weirdest part to me, was like the bill was from the hospital. So they had just kind of floated out this bill, seeing if we would go, oh, let's just pay it and move on. And I bet they do that a lot. That should be illegal. Like it's being billed to insurance or wherever else that is responsible for it. And they go, but what if we can get the people to also pay? What if we double dip here? And that seems to be legal. And that was maddening to me.
Yeah. And it's also strange that you don't have to pay, because there are a lot of bills that I think they sent out that people just don't pay. And like, I think there's other repercussions that happen, you know, but that's not like something in my mind that I thought was an option. I mean, I could pay it, but like, obviously, some people, they can't. And it is such a big, or I don't know if we can call it traumatic, but it's like an impactful experience that, like, now I have, like, what are the hospitals that are on, my, like, because I had insurance at the time, what are, like, covered? And I think most people who haven't had that experience, that's not the first thing they're thinking about when they have an injury. But then once that happens to you, that's the first thing you think about. And actually, there is this kid. So again, my wife, I'm using all these examples from her. They had a student who was working there who got mauled by a pit bull on their way to work. So they were like steps from an emergency room, and they were like bleeding out of their like groin or something. And they were like, I don't want to go into this hospital because I'm going to drive myself to another hospital because I know this is like what I'm covered in. And so like, it's, probably he had something similar, and so that's why you make these decisions. But like, that's not necessarily the first thing that should be going through your head. So
yeah, I mean, when you see that or hear a story of that, I just read this story years ago of like a woman whose health insurance didn't cover like childcare. So she stopped her job and then was doing like Uber Eats with her kid in the back seat. And just like that is a terrible equation. And yet it was a workable one that she could find, hopefully temporarily, while you search for that other thing that everyone else is trying to find, like that puzzle piece to come together. So you saw a very definitive problem. It's got to be at least an analysis of it. Maybe not a solution, but like, let's analyze it and like give some options as to how to avoid it. So surcharge a lot is, I just got, you know, hit by a car. I'm going to pull up this app while I'm laying here. And there's a pretty cheap hospital. Now you run the risk of it being like a Dr. Nick from The Simpsons sort of chop shop of like, yeah, get in here. We only charge $25. And that's a risk. But or you know that neighborhood, or you know like how dirty the facilities are, or whatever it may be. And you'd love to go to the most like opulent, you know, place you can be. But so you see that as a problem and you
like
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I hope no one's actually using this or would ever use this for, like, oh, I'm in an emergency. What should I do? I think for me, it was more like, man, it's crazy how different these prices are. It's more like an analysis tool because
yeah.
That's also strange. Like, why do we have, you know, 5x the cost of the exact same thing? And even within San Francisco, we're like 7 miles square. So it's like you could literally go 2 miles in another direction and save $1,000 on something, which is.
But people
again,
are pretty
this is like
good.
Assuming no one has insurance.
Yeah. But that is a way that people sniff stuff out. It starts as just a data analysis sort of experiment. And people get wind of it and they're like, just so you know, or they tell that story. They're on a podcast going, I knew this app surcharged a lot. And like, you know, I knew I wasn't going to bleed out. I knew time, like the clock was ticking. I calculated how much time I probably would have. I called a car. I went to the cheapest place. I got this done. It was Zed Network, blah, blah, blah. And then other people, now all of a sudden everyone knows about your app. And you're like, is this what it's come to? And you're like, that's not why I built it. I didn't build it to like create even more havoc within the medical world. But going to like that puzzle that everyone's trying to solve, which is I'd like to do something interesting with my life. I'd like to have some revenue or resources to also do these fun things, these excursion things. I want to travel. I want to see stuff. I want to go out to fun events. I want to, you know, be able to live a life and maybe, you know, not to get too off in the weeds, but you know, there are people that maybe would do a lot of psychedelics and just trust in like the spirit and the energy of everything. And they catch a ride to where they're going and, hey, it's good to have so-and-so here. They're kind of my guru. And over time, people are like, have you noticed that person never chips in? They don't do anything. Like, so that road can only last so long. Like at some point you got to kind of buy in, you got to put a name tag on or you got to scan whatever.
Yeah.
You got to do a service, and doing that service in a way that doesn't crush your soul is hard to find. And I think if you go to like any neighborhood in any given city, but the neighborhood where it seems like things seem a little too perfect here. It seems like they've found a life mate. They both drive really nice cars. It's a well manicured outdoor, you know, space, yard and such. The house itself is gorgeous. It seems like they wanted to have children. They lucked into it and had biological children. That's not a given. So they've been like granted a bunch of wonderful things. And even within that house that you would from the outside be like, that is who gets a life that lucky? They just went to Italy for 2 weeks or 2 months. Inside of it would probably be some complaining, some human complaining mm-hmm. of like, I'm so sick of my job. Jobs that they don't even talk about. You meet them and go, what do you do? Like, it's boring. Like, that fits your whole life. Yeah, I don't really like talking about it. That is so strange to me that like they just said that part of the puzzle doesn't matter. Whatever creates like the most revenue, I'm wired up that way, so that's fine with me. But a lot the world that I'm from, like arts and creativity, is people go, absolutely not. I know so many people that just have spent all their adult lives just barely getting by, just with the idea of something creative shaken out. And from the people in that house, that would look absolutely insane. That would be like, what are you doing? Go clock into something you hate and go to Italy for 2 months. You're like, I can't do it. So it seems like you're navigating that.
Yeah. And I think I've definitely moved. I'm not on either end of those spectrums, obviously, but I think I moved from like academia and like research out of that realm of like, and I think when we talked last time, you know, it was clear, like I wasn't that diehard, like, ah, I got to do the research all else. You know, I was kind of like, oh, this is cool. This is really interesting to me. And I was pursuing it. And I think I've heard about this, I don't know, Venn diagram, but it's like, you got to figure out, you know, what you're passionate about, what you're good at, and what kind of pays the bills. And you're like, ideally want something that, you know, meets those three somewhere in the middle of there. And I think, you know, the research world was something that I liked. I don't know. I like how good I was, you know, could be objectively defined based like on, you know, research funds or papers or whatnot, but like paying the bills, you know, it's just like, was a struggle. And so now I moved into another area. So yeah. So now, surprisingly, I work at a big bank and I'm on the sustainability team. So I'm still trying to do something that is sort of net positive for the climate, but in a completely corporate setting. So like it is a very, very different world. And in the financial industry, which is also a completely different world. And so it's been a, I mean, again, from my perspective, you know, it's just like a huge learning sort of environment. Like I'm learning all these new things about a bunch of different things, you know, like how, you know, the quote unquote business world work, or how, you know, if you think of climate change as, you know, we actually have to build a bunch of stuff, renewable energy project, you know, like all the like infrastructure things.
Yeah.
All of those need quote unquote financing. Basically, like you need upfront capital, like a loan essentially of some sort to build it.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of a whole new arena, a whole different lens of like how to move the needle. Rather than like the research world, which is like, so, you know, they'd be like, they're polar, not polar opposites, but they're pretty different. And so it's been super interesting learning about it. And I apply a whole different set of skills. So I had to learn a bunch of new skills essentially, but yeah, it's been very different.
I'll bet. But it also depends on how you would frame it in that, you know, if you're inside the belly of the beast, you look at like big corporate structures like that, a lot of times they are the most negligent, the most wasteful. The Hollywood movie system, very wasteful. There are people always on site trying to, hey, get everyone on staff to bring their own water bottle. Do you realize how many pallets of plastic water bottles you go through per day that are getting sipped, two or three sips, and then just wasted? It's not just that, like, it's, you know, throwing away tons of literal tons probably of food over the course of a year or something. And how do we stop that? How do we be a little more sustainable? And so I think being in that world, you can look at it that way. Like it boggles my mind every time you fly. I mean, flying in itself is for the haves to a certain degree, even the cheapest flights. I mean, there are lots of people on the low end of the socioeconomic spectrum that will never fly and have never flown. And just like the idea of affording that is outrageous. And yet the people that do fly all the time for business make a lot of money, get subscribed to magazines that are filling them in with the most up-to-date, here's how the world is, are just using so many little bits of plastic and wasteful things that, so for if someone like you gets in that and can be in those boardrooms saying, hey gang, what if, and just implementing this little fractional 0.1% of a change over the course of that many flights per day would be enormous. Say, I would guess that's the same with banks. So again, I wouldn't be, it sounds like you're being kind of hard on yourself for like entering that world, which.
Well, I think there's like, you know, a personal, you know, it's like an identity shift. And so I think, you know, I've been doing it for 2.5 years and I think I'm much more comfortable in it now, but definitely in well, cause I started the job in the pandemic. So it's like, I'm not interacting with a lot of people. So it's like all of a sudden I show up, I'm like in this new setting and then I've left behind this other world that I've been in for 10 years or so. So it definitely has been still a progression of that, you know, rethinking, you know, cause like you said, like what you do a lot of times that like people, you know, personalize that of like kind of who they are. And
yeah.
So just like this shift for me, but yeah, it's right. A big, you know, giant bank, if they move just a small amount, the impact is huge because of just how much of an influence they have. And so it's just thinking about things in different sort of volume or magnitude, you know, it's like a different equation. Whereas like before we were tackling things, and I think, you know, people along that entire spectrum are required to make the changes needed for, you know, even people who don't even work in climate change, just having conversations with your neighbors being like, oh, like kind of crazy, the weather now, you know, it's different.
Yeah.
So, and just having those conversations like, yeah, I'm putting in insulation. Have you heard of this contractor? You know, like all these things are part of the process. And so, yeah, I've kind of just moved into like a little different piece of that sort of big puzzle.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you're aware of it in the way that, you know, bands, when they start and they want to be ultra punk rock, and then maybe they sell their song to a place they're not so wild about, but then they get to maybe like, you know, put down a mortgage on a house or, you know, tour for once in a bus as opposed to piling into a minivan, or the things that you don't see behind the scenes of like, huh, we get to stay in a nice hotel and not crash on our friends' couches, whatever, like eases it up. You just, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of times you can see if maybe that opened a gateway to where they start making real cheesy corporate rock where you're like, oh no, they got a real accustomed to that. As long as they, but sometimes bands do it and then they stay true to themselves and they just recognize like that was a necessary step for what we wanted to do, where we wanted to get, you know, that's just part of the process. There's really not like a perfect way to do it. And so not everyone's justifying it, but I think it's to me more beneficial when people are aware of the thing that they, you know, if you just become ambivalent toward it, you become part of that wheel, then the thing you always feared. I'm the thing now. I'm the pig standing on their hind legs in Animal Farm. I became that. And you always want to be aware of like, no, I'm aware of stuff. I'm down here. And that does to me translate over into the arts a lot too.
Yeah, definitely. It's like an opening of the aperture, I think, in some ways. You know, you're like, okay, there's all these other things. There's all these other possibilities. Yeah. And I also heard somewhere that, like, you know, you can have, I don't know what the number was, but it was like 7 different careers or something like that. And so in our modern society, you know, people aren't sort of as pigeonholed into being like, this is the job I'm doing, gonna grind away for however many years. And so I kind of think of this as career number 2. You know, we'll see where it goes.
I like that. I think younger generations are going to feel that and really take advantage of that so much more. I look maybe in comedy right now is a phase where sharing clips repetitively with like subtitles on them, then going and doing shows and then parsing that show for clips and sharing them with subtitles. That would start to feel exhausting over a course of time. To do it for a few years, probably not that big a deal, like not that different from the MySpace boom or not that different from whatever thing was the next thing. But the idea of doing that consistently for 25 to 30 years, I don't think anyone thinks of it in those terms. Like, no way. Everything ends. Everything has a cycle and it ends. And mm-hmm. what'll be the next thing? I'll be uploading this or I'll be projecting things through VR or, you know, whatever the thing is. But I do think when people are in it, it feels like it's permanent. If you have the shift of perspective to say, I think it's only going to last for a little bit. I'm going to do it and try to enjoy it until I don't enjoy it. And then I'm going to shift and do something else. And I definitely entered comedy or stand up at a time when it was like, you're only true to the game if you can envision yourself still doing it at 75. You have to like adopt that. Okay. Yeah, I definitely. Mm-hmm. But if you ask me that about anything in my life, I'm like, I'm not agreeing to that. I want to like move and be, you know, malleable to what life is presenting to me so that I can be a little flexible. And so if you are in a place where you're like, was this ideal? No. But was it good? Yeah, maybe even great. But then I got not tired of it or bored, but just the compulsion to move on. And if that happens, then you go, all right, then I'll do the next thing and have the fourth or the third or the eighth or whatever career.
And I definitely think it took me, and maybe people are better at figuring this out. Well, I assume people are, but like it took me a while to figure out what things do I actually like doing. And so like in research, there's parts of that I really like doing, but there's like a ton of things I realized as I was doing, like, oh, I don't really like it. Like, You know, like, I don't like writing, you know, you got to write research papers, you got to write grants. It's like a huge part of it. And so I'm like, ugh, you know, and you got to work by yourself a lot. And so like a lot of people are independent and they can kind of just like charge on, but I kind of like to chit chat and have a team. And you could do that too in research. There are people who build teams and are deliberate about that. But in the work I do now, you know, it's kind of not the specifics, but the processes that I enjoy. I get to work with other people. I get to work over a variety of different topics, and I'm not like deep down into one specifically. And I realize like, oh, that's the kind of thing I like. I like being this integrator, being higher level necessarily, you know, and not necessarily like way deep down in the, I think they always say like an inch wide and a mile deep or something like that, which is like the PhD. And so I think I have like, you know, I've taken a step in the like, oh, these are the things that are more true to how I like to operate.
I think that is so valuable and recognizable when you see someone in your life who's maybe doing something that they said they would do. But when, if you ask them to step back, like, do you even still like this? Like, well, I told myself when I was 22 that I would do this. Like, but you got to come to, you got to take a little breath and just ask yourself if you like it. And I think like a thing I've thought about a lot, and I've had this discussion with people, is the notion of quitting. Like, you can't be a quitter. Never quit things. But I also think the things you love, you can never quit. It's like Brokeback Mountain. Like, why can't I quit you? Think of how many things you've been mad at, sick of, crumpled up, thrown in the trash, walk away, and you come back 20 minutes later and uncrumple it and work on it again, metaphorically or otherwise. But like, you can't quit the things that you're just drawn to. And I think people like seeing a puzzle piece fit into a puzzle. They like seeing dominoes one after another fall over. They like wires twisted together and a light bulb going on. We like connections. We like, and then understanding what are connections I like in life. If you're a business person and you like getting on that flight and closing the deal and, yeah, I think we got something here, and getting back on the flight and getting on the phone, I think we got them. You like that connection. And then if it's art, it's maybe drawing two different elements and placing them together, or concepts. And then, but it's just such a wide spectrum of, oh, I never thought I'd like this, but I really like this world that I got into because I get this kind of connectivity or this kind of puzzle solving, or I don't know. But I like that you're on that pursuit of like asking why. I think people sometimes just go through and just do, I don't know, just what you do, and never give it the thought.
And I think that's where I was, because it's sort of like, oh, you go to grad school. Oh, you keep doing the research. And it takes, I mean, for me, it took like literally, you know, running out of funding and like a pandemic. So like, it wasn't like, I didn't take a lot of credit for it. It was like kind of external. But yeah, I do think now I've been in some situations where it's like students will ask for, you know, advice. And I'm like always very clear, like, this is just my experience. I don't have like any advice for you. You're probably going to figure things out however you need to. But like, and someone told this to me. It's like a professor, I remember saying, like, you know, when you're in college, or this is also like freshmen, it's like, you think you know what you like now, and you may think you actually like that thing, and you may like it right now, but that's not the thing that you actually like, probably. Like, when you go through life, you're like, there's probably other things that you like more, because you haven't experienced enough of those things to do, or to like have that experience. And so I remember hearing that, and I was like a grad student at the time. I was like, oh yeah, that's a good piece of advice.
That is really good, really helpful. And I think everyone, as they get to a place in life when they can kind of look back, if you watch kids from age 3 to, I don't know when it ends, maybe 20 years old, they do a lot of stuff. They're painting and drawing and running and digging, and they're being exposed to everything. But then you get later in life and you followed that, well, I did this degree and I got this job, and it's not resonating with you. And then you start having memories like, you know, I think back to when I was a kid and I was always doing this. Like, well, you weren't always doing that, but you were doing it enough that you remembered it made you feel good, whether that was painting or like, I was always selling things out of my locker. I was born to be a salesperson, but I never realized it. And then I went into this career. It's all in how you look back and see yourself and like maybe things that you missed. God, I don't know why I went into this, because when I was a kid, I would always sneak away and do this thing. I was always playing music. I don't know why I got away from it. I think everyone has that, and it's just almost impossible, unless someone grows up like didn't touch anything else. I only played video games. I became a programmer. I got into game development, and that's my life. You would think, you're so lucky. You're so lucky that you knew that straight away and followed it and pursued it, because everyone else is just kind of like, I don't know, there's a lot of branches on this tree, and all of them are kind of appealing to crawl out on a little.
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, I do think I see people along that spectrum, because there are people who are like, oh, this is the thing I love doing, and this is like what I'm doing, and they're just like, well, they're really good at it, and they like it, and I think that's cool. And if you figure out what that is, I'm like, great, you know, and do that thing.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I also see a lot of people who are more drifty. I don't know what the word is. You know, like, oh, what's out there? What's going on? And that was definitely where I sit. And I still think I'm kind of like that, like learning new things.
Did you watch Station 11? It was like kind of a post-apocalyptic. It was very weird to watch after COVID and the lockdown. And
because I don't think so now.
I mean, it's strange the way it resolved. I won't get too into it, but like the components of it that really will bring you back to that period when they are sitting there watching the news, wondering which way it's going to go. And theirs goes the way we at times maybe feared, that it was like kind of the end of civilization. And it goes back to hunter gathering, foraging, bartering, putting on plays in a physical form, and no transfer of digital entertainment, no transfer, you know, no flying, no traveling, all these things that life has been built up off these little blocks. And yes, there are like plenty of good things at the base of it. Human interaction, breaking bread, sharing food, human interaction, eye contact, laughing, sitting around a fire, all these like convivial elements of what we all love about being alive at its best in that sense. Then, it, you know, we built it up. We built up from there to where there are these skyscrapers with people in suits talking about fractional percentages of some sort of merger and flights here and there to negotiate them, and all the money is kind of built off of the base still down there at the barter level of labor. And I think that's why we maybe fundamentally dislike that world of banking, in that you're people arguing on the table for scraps of things that were built by people that aren't even, that are way below the table and built like sort of on their backs. And you know, you could see that as a problem, and people go, I think at the base, like with socialism, you can't force people to work, and with capitalism, you can't force people to be nice. So how do you like reconcile those things and get them together? Very challenging to be like, you could enter the banking world and say, I can fix it. We can get people to be a little more kind, and maybe you don't need to argue for this 0.01% because you make $35 million this year. And the people who are doing the labor to build this, and I don't fully even understand how that all works, like shareholders and money and IPOs and all the things that make an economy function. It seems like in those buildings, though, is where they are arguing over the things that in a lot of ways are the most meaningless, right? They don't nourish or enrich people's lives. They just keep you safe. You've got your 401k and you've got your retirement and you're doing this job you hate, but you can look ahead for 20 years and envision a world where they take those shackles off you and you got a pile of money and you can finally go to Italy. And people look at that and go, that is the wrong way to do it. That is not life. That is, you got to live while you're here. And then, so maybe that's fundamentally why we kind of dislike that world, or where you would feel like, I'm in it, like I'm part of it. But I disagree with that. I think you're doing it in a way to like hopefully bring some enlightenment to it, or make it fractionally better, which it could use.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I think as well. Or at least that's why I'm doing it. I think there is some impact. And I think there, I mean, and also like, I don't know, you know, I've been working in the, you know, financial sector for like 2.5 years now. There's like so much I don't know. There's a lot that I've learned, but like, there's so many things about the details that I'm like, may never know. You know, there's people who are like, in theory, experts. They've been doing this their whole life, whatever those specific deals are, and working out the terms, or, you know, there's a lot of things that's complicated. There's a lot of things that are relatively simple that I think I have a handle on. But yeah, I think and I got this from sort of like my boss and my boss's boss now, like, and he wasn't always working in the banking sector, but he's like, is, you know, like what I said before, like a fundamental thing we need to do to solve the climate problem is like build a bunch of stuff. And that stuff is like technologically better than the old stuff, which you'd think is a good thing. And most people over time have always built better things from a technological standpoint. But to build those things, you need to pay for them.
Yeah.
It's weird. That's like, you know, that's just how the society works, you know? And like, I don't know. I had a professor who was sort of had this slide deck where he'd talk about like, what are we actually doing? Like, why are, you know, what is the actual challenge? And he said like, you know, he had like a reference, which I always think is good for people. Like, what's the thing that we've already done that's sort of similar to this? And he was like, well, you know, the generation before us, they like built the interstate freeway system. Like, we can now drive from California to New York. You know, we couldn't do that before. There were no roads. There were no rail. You know, there's all these things, all this infrastructure, all these houses, all these hotels. You know, there's all this other stuff that we built. Like, we're good at building stuff. We've built tons of stuff. And so, like, that's essentially what we're doing now. It's a different reason. There's a different kind of goal to it. But, like, if you think of it in simplest terms, that's, like, one of the big chunks of the pie or the puzzle of like getting to where we need to get to.
I feel better having you in maybe not the biggest meetings, but at least adjacent or someone that they would reference or just.
I'm in the building somewhere. Like, where is that guy?
You're that guy in that little room by the mail room, by the boiler room. Run this by him. But thinking of humans and how much of where we are now is kind of just by happenstance, a little bit by accident. It feels more purposeful and it feels more malicious, and we feel like you know, when you see people poaching, when you see people harming animals just for fun, just for shootsies, that's a bummer, because then you feel like, man, humans are a really trash organism. But then you see people being great to animals, to each other, mm-hmm. and you think the electric car was in the mix in the late 1800s and steam, and then petroleum and the combustion engine just kind of won out. And I think it was because the assembly line, and it just could be manufactured cheaper, and maybe the ability to mine the materials necessary. And if you're listening and you know a lot about this, please email me. I'd love to know so much more, because I think we were very close at one point to one of those winning out. And say it's electric, the electric cars in 1885, they could go like 20 miles an hour for up to 50 miles. That's pretty good to just make a battery and make it work. And like, that's a starting point to get better at building it from there. So say that it was more cost effective back then. And we lived in a world where that had been, the idea of using something else was incomprehensible. Ah, it's too expensive to mine. It's too expensive to pump the oil. It's too expensive to transport it. And now some of the meetings you're adjacent to, they might be getting asked by one of the big companies to foot the bill, to, you know, loan them the money, or at least chip in to one of these gigantic undertakings to pipe oil out of a reserve where it ruins ecosystems and traverses across native land and on and on and on. And you're listening like, oh, that's beyond just it being an eyesore. What about a spill? No, we never spill. They always spill. And then you're just listening going, that's strange. Maybe I can coerce them to like, what if we, you know, invest more in, and I don't even know what it would be, solar panels or wind turbines, or just let's move over here a little bit. It's weird to think that at any moment there's a shift that could happen. It happened with electric vehicles versus the combustion engine at one point, and now we're 100 years later plus going, oh, this is how that reality looks. Maybe there's a different reality in a different dimension where the electric car worked out. Humans are still the same. Would they feel self-assured mm-hmm. and confident, like, we always do things right? I don't think so. But the world would definitely look different.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there was, and I haven't seen this, but I feel like people have mentioned to me, there's like a documentary about the electric car that could have been. And so I should look that up. I feel like that would be super interesting.
Please pass it along.
And
it's
just kind of like
a
you know, I feel like there's a lot of things like that where we're just like, oh, shoot, we could have had this thing take over. I always think, at least with solar and wind, I mean, it's free energy, right? It's just like coming out of the sky. It's just like literally just,
yeah,
you know. And And so, yeah, you have to build it out to work with our system, because our system wasn't built for that, capturing that type of energy. But, like, in theory, and that's why, again, like, the financing stuff works. Like, right now, at least, you got to foot the bill for building this technological solution that, like, yeah, this fuel source is free. So, like, the other stuff, the you got to pay, or mine or whatever, you got to get the fuel source. That's not unlimited and it's not free. But the thing that you're building, we've been building it for years, so we've gotten super efficient at building that, and so it's going to be cheaper up front to build another one. And so, you know, I don't know all the answers, but, like, in theory, I think it'll be, I mean, I always think, like, in the future when we look back, even just like with cars, we're like, you guys were driving these things, you had to fill them up every time, and there's just spitting out all this, like, pollution, you know, because, like, it just seems like such a kind of weird, you know, it's kind of like, oh, the equivalent of, like, oh, yeah, we have, like, you know, a fire in our house and we're cooking, which a lot of people still do, you know, that's, like, a huge issue. People are, like, using cook stove, but it's, like, now we don't have that. That's, like, a technological advancement. And so, like, I don't know, I think a lot of these things technologically make a lot of sense, and we're going to move in that direction. How fast is, I think, the biggest challenge. And to do it in a way where you're not losing people who have had to deal with the problems of the old stuff, still dealing with the problems as we move into the next phase. And so I think that's also hard to think about and another challenge to consider. So there's a lot of challenges, but I think we're, like, moving forward.
Yeah, I'm trying to, like, triangulate all of these things, like, why this animosity toward big banks and stuff. And part of it, I think, also stems from when an economy is up and working, you got to keep it going. So if someone says, hey, well, what if we slow this down? At some point, handing in milk bottles and getting them filled back up by the dairy and then having a milk person deliver your milk, or returning your Coke bottles, or really just a bottle industry of recycling wasn't thought of as anything other than, like, well, yeah, I'm done with them. I'm going to give them back. That's pretty sustainable to a certain degree. Maybe it just, when plastic gets in the picture, everyone goes, oh, thank goodness, I can break all these bottles now. I can just chuck them. I don't have to think about it. And then plastic takes over, and down the road, people go, you know. And then the people at the bank are like, don't let that word get out there, that we could go back to this. Brand that as being foo-foo-ish and silly, and you know, it's no big deal to waste them. And we'll recycle these in recycling bins, which we do, I don't know, 1% of the time. And so the manipulation and the sort of propaganda that seems to come in with that to keep things going, where we did have those things. Maybe we're in the middle right now, where electric car future that didn't happen, close. The returning bottles, close, didn't happen. But we're also just in this petroleum or, you know, fossil fuels world. And maybe there's a third one that we avoided, and we're beating ourselves up because this current one has proven to be pretty detrimental to the planet. But maybe we should be going, hey, at least we didn't do that third one. At least we didn't one where it's just fire and ash everywhere, and we're all roaming around with zero greenery. You know, we don't look at it that way. We go, we got to correct this one, which is fair, but it seems like it could be done. And then if you can be in there in the building helping, I feel better about that than, like, the banks going unchecked. Like, now we got to keep people buying more of this and more of this. And someone in the room to go, but that's bad. That's hurting, you know, it's limiting our timeline to be here on this planet as a species. Ah, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it's a tough, I mean, there's always probably worse things, which is probably not something great to think about, like, worse ways we could have done it. But I think there's always people, you know, I don't know if you want to call it pushing, but people, like, working towards, because even at a place like, you know, any probably, you know, corporate, giant corporation, now that I've sort of been in a big corporate environment, you know, there's people who are there, like, pushing as hard as they can to try and do, like, the good thing. And there's, like, I think people in society, you know, I think, like, in every I don't know what I want to call it, like, unit of organization, there's kind of, like, people pushing in the positive direction, trying to make things, like, head in that direction. And so, like, in society, there are the people who are going to be, like, protesting, and the people who are, like, you know, getting in people's faces. And then in, you know, at a university, there's going to be people who are pushing the envelope, trying to do things. So I feel like at every level, there's always people moving in that direction. And I think it took me a while to realize that and be like, okay, I can be one of those people in a different sort of setting or a different sort of unit of organization.
Yeah. I was talking to a friend the other day. He was like so mad at this person parking next to him. He's like, he was picking something up. So he was parked in a parking spot. And he goes, there's a spot like behind me, to the left of me, both spots are open. This person could have just pulled straight through and parked. But instead, he's backing this van very inefficiently, like an 18-point turn to get it back next to me. And I said, oh, I read this profile years ago on a Trump person. And their whole thing was, which is hilarious, but their whole thing was follow all the laws, obey all the laws. And you can't cut through the stalls at a grocery store. You got to go around the end cap of the aisle and then pull into your parking spot. And I go, it wouldn't surprise me if this person similarly didn't want to pull through two spaces. That's illegal. He sends me a screenshot or sends me a photo later. And on that person's dashboard, a Trump hat. I'm like, yeah, that's predictable. Amazing. And so that was kind of a fun one. But I, at the heart of it, I was like, why does that bother you? I think there's, I don't know if this is true or just anecdotal, but like Nietzsche, the philosopher, removed from society and kind of lived remotely away from humans. And one day walked outside and saw a man beating a mule. And then Nietzsche had an aneurysm and died on the spot. And I think to some degree, if you're a bit of a misanthrope, you can relate to that story. Like being around humanity, challenging. It's just, mm-hmm. It presents, when you're around it, you know, you can have 99 good interactions and then you just see something that's a problem and that's humans. We want to solve it. So I'm asking my friend, like, why do you care about that? And he's like, it's so inefficient. It bothers me. But I go, well, I'm like, have your wife follow you around for a week and just audit you of the things that are inefficient or that bother her or where you're leaving a towel where it shouldn't go or leaving water all over the sink or whatever it is. I guarantee you, you'll find that. And that's likely with everyone. So if we're all chasing each other mm-hmm. around going, but you did this, you didn't put your registration thing on your license plate in time or you didn't lock up your bike. It's just if you enter into society, you're entering into an imperfect stew of things. And I think that's
I do think even within the like that's like the rules element, but I do think that applies also to the like environmental or climate impact. Like at a personal level, I think a lot of times people assume, because I did an environmental sort of science engineering background, that like I am taking it to the extreme in my personal life of like whatever the things in their imagination is what like an environmentally conscious person would be doing, you know, what
you're at home on a stationary bike powering the lights in your house.
Exactly. You know, like I've done every, you know, sort of climate impacty type thing. But I think that's just like kind of like this guy, like it would drive you nuts if that was actually what you tried to do as at the personal level. And I think this is what Casey Hadmer said, like, the actual impact of, if you calculate the actual impact of a lot of the things that people think are making a difference, they don't make a difference. Like at the like, you know, the global CO2 level, they're tiny. Yeah. And so having that perspective also, it's tough because you don't want people to just like not try to conceptualize and do something. People do like that feeling of like, hey, I'm having an impact. So you don't want to say like, that doesn't have an impact. It doesn't matter. But at like some level, if you put something in the compost or in the recycling that should have gone in the compost and you're getting angry and you're fishing it out, or if you leave the lights on all day and you come home or something like that, like now with LED lights, you know, like, I don't know, you can leave them on for, I don't know, however, I mean, I'm not saying you should, but in any case, there's these incremental levels that I think one of the climate podcasts I heard was like, you got to just do what you feel like is for you personally making an impact. And it's not necessarily going all the way out and calculating the CO2 emissions, because at the end of the day, like the really big impacts, the really big things that, you know, again, are these where we get our energy, where we get our, you know, your industrial stuff and like steel, you know, these are the other like big things that like, you know, your neighbor's not going to be able to make a difference in like, like how we're getting our energy. I mean, they could vote. That's what I always tell people. I tell a lot of young people, like, what's the biggest thing you can do? They usually want me to say, like, ride your bike, or, you know, I always just say, like, vote.
Yeah. Well, and I think when you see at, like, exit polls, young people talking about it, I mean, that's what gets them excited, is being very well aware, like, future generations didn't really take us into consideration all that much. And, you know, the viability, both financially, to own a home and not live with my parents mm-hmm. when I'm 30, but beyond that, like, breathe clean air and, you know, have a workable or livable ecosystem. And so taking that on, okay, well, that's our call to act. That's fun to think about, a whole generation of people being like, you goofs really messed this up, and we're gonna, like, come along and be mindful about it. And, you know, hopefully they and you see that, like, with the scooping plastic up out of the ocean, or the little things that seem marginal. Have you ever seen one of those mm-hmm. military trains go by? It'll be like a mile long with just military equipment on it. You just think of, like, how much steel that is to produce. And then you think of your neighbor, like, oh, one of your water bottles fell out of your bin. Go pick that up. That puts it in perspective of how absurd that feels. And yet, when you have the connectivity, the wires that you touch together that make a light, you can't comprehend that other people wouldn't think of that the same way. I mean, I'm always, like, repurposing wood and restaining or re-oiling. It just lasts me forever because I'm like, oh, this is a very viable substance if you treat it right. And then I'll have people that
We have the same affliction. My wife has to tell me, like, when we see a pile of wood, that, no, I can't.
We'll be walking, like, pushing, like, the shoulder, she'll go, leave it, like a dog, leave it. Like, no, but this
it's
pretty.
Like, if I'm out walking by myself, I'll be like, come home with, like, a handful of wood. Like, ha-ha.
Yeah, one time she came in and I had, and this is impressive because it was heavy. It was like someone had this 1x12 pine wood entertainment center. So it's tons of wood all together in 3-ish to 5-ish foot lengths. And I hoisted it up and, like, penguin walked it all the way down the street and got it in the house. And then she came in and just went, oh, good. It's just like this giant thing sitting there. But so many of the things around are now made out of that wood, just repurposing it. And, like, from trash, there's a real solid feeling there of, like, I took it off the street. It's no longer waste. It's reused. And, I mean, the financial benefit of, like, finding free wood, great. And then so I'll have people, though, that are, like, rocket science, you know, genius level smart, like, oh, I'm having trouble building this thing I found it, or I got it at IKEA. And I'm just like, IKEA just sells trash. 90% of the things you see on the side of the road that are unfixable, can't be repurposed, is crappy particle board made in IKEA in a hurry, put together with Allen wrenches. And so that's the sort of thing to me. I'm like, but you? I picture you, like, driving a flying car and knowing how all this stuff works. And it doesn't work that way. Not everyone is going to have the same sort of perspective or excitement at free wood that you and I have.
But it is, I mean, it is only more recently, again, since I started kind of getting into it, that I realized how amazing something that is built out of, like, solid wood is compared to, like, all the other stuff that we have. And so,
yeah.
But I am kind of a crazy person now. I swear, it felt like it was, I don't know, some magical day. My neighbor must have been, like, cleaning out his wood shop and just, like, left all these, like, scraps of wood, like, bundled up nicely. And I was just like, every day there was, like, a new bundle. I was just, like, hauling it into. And of course, the sort of workshop that I have, again, I live in San Francisco, so we were, like, very space limited. So during the pandemic, I basically converted the storage unit that every unit in our building has, which is about like 3 at the widest by 9. It is like tiny, teeny tiny, into my woodworking shop. It has my bike in there. It has our other, like, storage stuff. So it is like a teeny tiny wood shop. But now it's got all these bundles of little scrap wood that who knows what opportunities there are to build.
Man, you'll find them. I have some that's just been sitting around, and every so often I've learned to be less precious with it. For a long time, I'd be like, well, those pieces all have to go together. I'm going to have to make something where, like, I just have to match. And now if I just need something, I'll just grab it, make it, and be like, well, that's now gone. I've now made it. But it starts to feel good to chip away at it. And there's a part of me that wants to get down to zero, no wood laying around.
Zero.
And just
zero
start
wood.
Again. Zero wood. Like
the corporate equivalent of that is zero inbox, I think is the term, where people have like no emails in their inbox or no unread emails. But zero wood is the equivalent for us.
We're like striving for zero wood, but sustainable and productive, you know, making things out of it. And I do like when I give it away and people like have shown up and be like, all this? I'm like, man, I know that feeling. That's a good one. It's nice to pass that forward. And hard though, really hard to be like, I have to come to grips with like, I'm not going to use all of this. And I just can't keep having it laying around. But I, you know, it's so useful. It's so helpful, like not having to run somewhere and being able to make stuff. And then I've gotten into like a solar power station. And so like using the sun and figuring out how I, you know, if I'm turning stuff, if I could get like a little lathe that could run off of that, I, you know, back in the like Nordic culture, I think they would use kind of a foot pedal sort of, you'd tie a rope up on like a tree limb above you, wrap it around something and then wrap it to your foot. And then you just go up and down and it kind of spirals your lathe back and forth. And so that was very like human powered, and now like taking that a step. And I think that could be, I mean, this is just getting off into like idiosyncrasies, but when you start to get into those things of, well, fun to build wood, fun to repurpose things, fun to like have it be a net sort of zero. But then when does it stop? When does it start getting like, all right, this is a bit much. I don't need to hand smelt my tools and like all the steps to, you can go and purchase stuff. You can go and, you know, invest a little.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't necessarily need to buy, because then I was always looking for like old Craigslist tools of like hand planes or spoke shaves and just trying to get everything that's like, you know, secondhand. So I have like one, of course, I was like, oh, that's the way. And I have a bunch of like spoke shaves that like I can't even use because it's like, I don't really, you know, like I tried sharpening it and it still is not really working out. So I'm like, okay, well, so I don't know if that's really. So some things basically do have a lifeline or a life limit.
Have you gotten into white distilled vinegar?
For like cleaning up blades?
Yeah.
So I have seen that as an option, but I didn't go that route. So I did or I don't know what the proper term is, but I had these like, you know, again, Distin saws that were all rusted, and I just kind of used some machine oil and some like, you know, scrubbing and sanding, and it got enough that I didn't have to go the vinegar route.
Yeah, you can, if you have heat, if you have like a heat torch, you know, you can just kind of burn rust off. That's pretty cool. But if you just soak it in the vinegar, it's that feeling of like plugs going into sockets that just like is satisfying for some reason. If you make like a mortise and tenon joint and like thunk, to just wipe away, you know, old stain or old rust, and it just shiny metal shows up underneath it. That's a thing that my brain is like, that's good. I like that. And so cleaning up old blades or like wire brushing them, and then, man, what a great thing to get something. And
yeah,
those videos
are so
pieces, satisfying.
I don't know what they're called, but like in a saw blade that like actually hold the saw, or in a saw, like hold the blade to the handle, the wooden handle, those little pieces.
Yeah.
Because you can like, a lot of times they're brass, you can like shine them up. Yeah. And it's just like, wow, this looks so nice.
Yeah.
I think we have a similar wavelength there of like trying to get the something old to like, I mean, because they're, or to me, they look so cool.
Yeah. It is, I mean, to the banks, to the economy, that is like you need people purchasing, you need consumers, you need obsolescence, you need things to break so that people buy it again new. And I get that, but and it's kind of asinine to keep everything going. But there was a period where we made stuff, even, you know, here in this country, for that you needed to buy once. You can get like a white sewing machine from the 20s that still works perfectly. And that's not a great economic model. I think the Instapot or the One Pot a few years ago was the latest thing that happened with. Their company had to like totally pivot because they were like, introducing the Instapot 2. And people were like, this one still works great. That's not very smart. And so when I'm fixing stuff up, I'm like, this thing still works.
Product.
Yeah, like an old Stanley No. 8 hand plane. I mean, those are so valuable because like they will go forever and they're still so good and they look cool. Those things are just... It's like a different period. And we're getting so off topic of like, but it is about sustainability. Like, what do you need and how can you get the things you need?
and about like doing, I do think one of the things for woodworking for me is like a pursuit that helps me to practice like letting go of perfection. And I think like as a PhD, as like a scientist, you know, I feel like you're always trying to like, you know, run all the tests to make sure this analysis is like done perfectly. And I feel like with wood, you're like, well, if you took off too much, like you're not getting it back, you know, yeah. You got to move on. You got to just, you know, complete it. It's done. And, you know, I mean, if you're super skilled, then like, you know, I always see those, what is it, Paul Sellers, where he's like, oh yeah, you can just shave off 1 millimeter with this. And I'm like, okay, I'm not at that level. So there's people who are able to do that. But for me, it's been a good exercise of just being like, let it go.
Yeah.
Move on.
The meditative element, the kind of idle hands and keeping your hands busy. I'll say a lot of things before I start, like I'll take a deep breath and go, mistakes will happen. And then I just kind of let myself know that and do it, especially because I'm always kind of like you are when you have to move your stuff. You don't have the big Midwestern giant barn where you can just walk in and flip on a light switch and go to work. I have to like transformer stuff out a lot of times. And I like that. Like things mm-hmm. have to serve multiple purposes and fit in this small space where I have to take them out and reconfigure them. But so that takes some time. So I'm always kind of working fast. So how do you do that, but also be sort of present and calm about it, not make mistakes because you're working too quickly? And all that is a part of it for sure. But in the end, you're trying to like make something and or serve a purpose so that you're not just constantly purchasing. And I think to me too, I'm really drawn to like inventors or people who use their brains or minds in a way to like max it out. So when you talk about like AI doing all the Photoshop stuff or just, I'm going to go to my phone. Like I love YouTube tutorials. I love how humans are sharing stuff these days, but I also like just sitting there and being like, can I figure this out? Because a whole generation, a whole timeline of people lived and did incredible things with their mind. And I think we're still doing that, but maybe not on a person to person basis. Maybe that's what frustrates us. Of like this person's mind is off. They are just buying what they're sold. They're watching the dumbest stuff. They're not challenging themselves. They just are a human. They're just going through the ride with the light turned off. And that frustrates me. I'm like, but am I doing that? How much can I turn it on? How much can I, what can my brain do? I don't know. But I like that wood kind of helps with that sometimes.
Yeah, it is fascinating to try and solve a problem. And maybe that's just also something that I feel like it's always weirdly similar between artists and like engineering scientists. I like they like to like, even though it's like a, you know, they're not really both problems, but like they are trying to solve a puzzle in some way. They're trying to like create something, and that requires this like mental processing of like, okay, how do I actually get from where I am now to like the end? And so like there's a lot of similarities there, and I think it's funny, or it's fun for me to try and work through that. And sometimes, you know, the idea is like, oh, wait a second, this doesn't actually work. You know, like create this little thing and it just like falls down. I'm like, oh, I needed another piece there to hold it up. So I think that process is also fun for me. I could assume for some people that's like super frustrating. They wanted to get it perfect. But I feel like I hear artists and they're probably comedians. You know, you try and create this thing and you've got to constantly be tweaking it because like the first way you get it out may not be the actual way that works. And, you know, you're running it by other people who have that similar type of brain and they can add things to it and try and help it get to this like next step. And then like, it's always, I don't know, for me, again, my friend in Minneapolis, I'll be working on something and he'll be like, oh, you should do it this way or turn this thing around, you know? And I'm like, oh yeah, that actually does work better. So
yeah, I think that I was writing this sketch the other day, and it was like kind of from the 20s, and this sort of voice. Well, you know, and I feel like for whatever reason they said back then, like a man likes to know what he's getting, a man likes to see what he's gonna. And one of the characters said something. I just kind of wrote it offhand, like, well, a man needs to know the problem before he can come up with a solution. And I thought that was so dumb, but also so 20s-like. But then the more I thought about it, I was like, that there's something to that. Like, you kind of need to know the problem. And so much of just comedy in general is you're illuminating what to you is a problem, And maybe that's what resonates with people. And problems like loosely defined, just an anomaly, mm-hmm. something atypical, something we all go, oh yeah, why is that? And if you can be very satirical about it and or illuminate something where people go, yeah, we all should stop doing that. That's mm-hmm. science. That's the same thing. That's when you're working on sustainability. Identify what is the problem. If you just get to work on it, solve it. Like, solve what? Well, how do we get people to, okay, well, what's the problem with that? You start going back to the beginning, and that made a lot of sense to me. I'm like, that was such a dumb line, like a throwaway line. But then I was like, there's really value in knowing I see this, and it's a huge problem to me, and I watch everyone walk by it and not notice it. I'm going to write something. I'm going to say something. So it is, like you're saying, like, it's dumb, it's silly, but when a crowd of people laughs, you're like, I think I illuminated that problem a little.
Yeah. Yeah, and there is a, again, from like an engineering perspective, because I feel like I've been in lots of, you know, team settings or, you know, where there's a problem, and people see the problem as like the bad thing. But like, really, as an engineer, I always felt like we were taught, like, well, you have constraints. That's what is the purpose of engineering. You have to like build something with constraints. You don't have a limitless thing. That's not like an engineering problem. You're like, okay, you have limitless everything.
Yeah.
Go do it. No, it's like, oh no, here are the constraints. Here are the issues that were, you know, presented with. Now we solve that. And so like, that's the other thing that I feel like for woodworking, for comedy, for whatever corporate job you have or sustainability or science. Yeah. You were like, oh, okay. Well, like these are the issues, these are the constraints, and that like generally you get better solutions, not necessarily when you have more constraints, there's probably a limit there, but like that's the whole process.
Yeah. I think I've brought this up on the show before, but the old Windows startup, Brian Eno wrote that, and he was saying, you know, like he's thought of as this very like avant-garde, imaginative, like, you know, but sort of not unconstrained artist. And then yet Microsoft had a million things. It's got to sound uplifting. It's got to sound this. It's got to be quick. It's got to be sharp. It can't be this. It has to be. And he was like, you could think of that. Oh, and also it has to happen in like 1.8 seconds or something like that. Like, he was like, you could look at that as overwhelming and like too much of a burden. He's like, but I thought it was the best because it gave me these boundaries to work in, and then like, can I do all this stuff within these boundaries? And so yeah, I think that a lot of times is very helpful, like identifying the problem, like we got to identify boundaries too, you know, and all those elements are very challenging to and fun when you solve them. It's just the plug going in or the wires getting touched together of like, ha, okay, I solved this. But sometimes it's not the puzzle. It's just figuring out, what would the analogy be there with the puzzle? Just figuring out like how many pieces there are to it, or like how big it should be. Just knowing that, like, okay, well now I know where to start. Then it's just a matter of like connecting them.
Totally. Yeah. My first like real woodworking project was this milking stool, and everybody I told, like, milking stool, it's not really useful. I was like, well, you know, you have a point, it's true. But like, it was like to learn all the, it was like a way to, you know, learn all these certain specific skills. And so it like, you create a problem to like teach yourself how to, you know, like I had to, yeah, I think the joint, you know, again, it was like no screws. So it's like a, I don't know if it's a mortise and tenon, but basically there's like a round peg that goes through, and then you got like a little wedge that holds it into place, and
yeah,
has a spoke shave a square piece into a round piece, you know. So
yeah,
it was very satisfying to learn. And yes, you're right, getting a joint right to, you know, kind of mallet to get it stuck right in place, it is very satisfying.
Yeah, I some of those little things that like in woodworking especially no one will really ever see. It's just your brain solving stuff that you go, people have been doing this for centuries. But like, you know, when something's broken, and then I'd love to like whittle and carve a rough connector piece there, glue it, and then like either spoke shave it or just kind of sand it down to where, that is now fixed and it can go in the hole. Because I love finding broken stuff, and you just watch a human brain at work, and you see like four different types of glue. But the whole time the joint was extraordinarily loose. So they just thought, I'll just dump so much glue in there, it'll form. And you see that, and you can feel a little like, oh, these fools. Knowing that like at some point your brain was in that same spot. The only difference is like you pushed through it a little bit. You kept figuring out. And then once you understand sort of the material properties, It's like a puzzle piece. It just goes into like,
totally.
How did I not know this? And how does everyone not know this? Like, this is how you do it. You don't just dump glue. It's got to be rigid. It's got to be tight in there. People will like hinges on a door. They will always just go longer and longer screws. But you should just take like toothpicks and put them in there and create more friction between the screw and the hole. When you learn something like that, you're like, well, everyone should know that.
But yeah, the material properties of wood, I always thought of like once I started working on wood, like my science background, actually, I was like, oh, if I would have known this, that like it teaches you about like, oh, the structure of kind of like the inner workings of like the vascular sort of, or like, you know, how they're transporting, you know, it's like all these things kind of connected. And I was like, oh, this is very fascinating. Yeah, there's a lot of weird sort of knowledge that's built into woodworking that around all sorts of different things that I've been geeking out over as I go further into it.
Same. Yeah, the fibers, the different resins, the I find myself like wanting to get into welding a lot more just because like the atomic sort of breakdown of heat and you know, just molecularly, like what's happening with that sort of restructuring or you know, heating it way up, exciting them and then cooling them down. And like, now you're conjoined and that seems fun. And all these things that like all these different careers where if you are a welder, you might have a very different perspective on science. And yet you and I would be like, hey, I'm a fan. I like you, like what you do day to day is requires so much interesting, like innate chemistry knowledge and physics and. So I like, you know, I also like being around like a master and I have, I used to have a much different interpretation of what that meant. My friend Jesus is a shoemaker and if he would, but he loves repairing stuff too. There's like no difference between building. He built shoes for like a very famous basketball player, like size 18 giant shoes. And then he'll also like you come in with like, oh, the heel's a little loose on this shoe. Like, yep, we'll glue it up and cobble it back together and sand it and polish it. Here you go. But there is no downtime. There's no because he's seen everything a million times over and he's repaired them. He's taken them apart. So people would come in and they'd be like, this purse belonged to my grandmother and it is extremely. And he'd be like, yep. You just start working on it in the same way you would be like, ah, this shoe I don't care about. The heel he just. It's the repetitiveness, and then the person before they can even be like, but that was my grant, they get it back, like, oh, yeah, that's perfect, thank you. To me, that's a master. Yeah. It's like you've seen it over and over to where, like, nothing is precious, and you don't sit there and take deep breaths and go, oh, I'm going to make mistakes. You just go, you intuitively know that. I'm going to make mistakes, but I'm going to solve them equally as quickly.
Yeah, people who've just been around something and have been working with something for, like, you know, I talk about like Paul Sellers, he has this YouTube, you know, and he's always talking about like, oh, you know, I don't know, cut whatever thousand, you know, sort of dovetails on this project. And so then I built all these things. It's like, yeah, I've cut like 17 dovetails, you know what I mean? Like, of course I'm not going to be as good as him. And so like, but yeah, and I'm like super, or, you know, trying to be very exact, but like, it just, still going to be making the same mistakes. Actually, the whole shoe purse thing, maybe this isn't a great analogy, but what makes me think of is, because I've had a lot of friends now who've had kids, but it's like the nurses in the hospital, they like grab the babies and they wrap them up. They're like kind of rough with them, but like,
yeah.
You know, they've dealt with thousands of babies, so they know how it works and then know what to do. Is so like when we grab them, I'm like, oh, I don't know what I'm doing with this thing, you know,
yep.
But they're like, yeah, they're going to be fine, you know? So,
and I maybe this is just helpful to like general well-being, mental health, but to just sit there and take deep breaths about cutting in some dovetails and then you make them and they're not great. But I've over time started to be like, I like the imperfections. I like the little signature. If it's too robotic and perfect, I almost feel like that has no personality. So then I start to enjoy like, you made something? Is it kind of bad? Let me see it. I want to see like, and if I can see where you struggled or like, oh yeah, you rounded this one. Oh, then it gets down in that trough and you round that. Oh, it feels bad, huh? But I would know what you've, and I only know that because I've done it, and then there's connectivity, and that probably speaks more to humans not having that elitism. I know this, and you don't know that. That's the worst.
Yeah, and I do feel like any craft, or you know, striving towards any craft, or striving towards any high level of anything, I think gives you the humility. And I think, yeah, weirdly, like, through my PhD, like towards the end, the thing that I got the most was being able to be like, oh, I don't know this, well, I don't know what that is. You know, but I don't know, you know, like, I'm supposed to be the expert in XYZ, but just to be able to be like, not quite sure, or I don't know how to do that, or, you know, I was actually joking with my friend, my dovetails, what I learned how to do was to cut little wedges to fill all the gaps, because I had so many gaps in all my so I learned that skill, you know, not many people have to do that.
Yeah, I've definitely cut stuff short and left little gaps where I'm like, that's no big deal. And then I'll think about it as I'm going to sleep and like, yeah, cut little plugs and like, you barely notice. Like, yeah, they're there. One time I did that with what was supposed to be like a blackout box for screen printing. So you couldn't really let light through, but I was like, that's just barely short. I had to cut little plugs and then like, you just solve it. And no one's ever brought it up. No one's ever noticed. People do not care.
Exactly, yeah.
My grandfather was a really great woodworker, and he hadn't done it in a long time, but I would always come in from like working on stuff and complain, and he'd be like, you're too hard on yourself. And I'd be like, God, I was so good, and then I messed it up. I'd be like, you know, like your table there, it's perfect. And he goes, I can tell you what's wrong with it. And it was like revelatory. And he'd be like, look underneath, look like at that spot, and then you see it, and you're like, but you're perfect. You're a master. You're like, no, everyone makes mistakes. Just like how much you beat yourself up, you know, that's a compulsion. I made this table. Let me show you what's wrong with it. Why would you do that?
Yeah. Yeah. One of my postdoc advisors is super famous, and he had, you know, super long career. I think he's probably still doing science, but he's just fascinating. But like, I would ask him like, oh, how do you kind of keep it up and get all this? And he's like, I'm always 2 weeks behind, you know? It's like, always kind of like not where exactly I want to be. So it's like, even if you're like in your, you know, I think it's probably in his 80s and have a like prolific career, you know, I kind of always both realize like it's, you know, there's nobody who's at that like level of quote unquote perfection. It's not a thing.
No, it's not. Yeah. And it's when to get to that, to understand that, it just frees you up so much. It's just so much more freeing than to be like, well, I can't proceed unless I'm perfect. That's, if when you say it out loud, you're like, that is an asinine thing to think.
Yeah.
Well, man, this has been so fun. It's really good to catch up.
Yeah,
and I'm glad to hear about this new endeavor. And even though we didn't get too much into the specifics of it, like, it seems like you're enjoying the good parts and living a life that, you know, had, like everyone, like you're navigating it and rowing, like we
exactly
touched on.
Yeah, moving you know, towards that, whatever that next step is. I feel like we don't know where the stairs go, but we're like heading up to that next step.
Yeah. No, that's awesome. We'll come back and do it again. I mean, this is fun to catch back in. I've been saying that more frequently and reaching out to previous guests. Oh, thank you again for referencing or hipping me to the audio being off in that one episode. And no thanks to
episode.
No one else. Oh, thanks. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, those were good ones. I feel like the restart has been great for me, too. I've actually been going back to listen to some old ones as well. So.
Oh, cool. Well, I love doing the show, and I like every time I start getting in a rhythm of getting back into it, something comes up that could just be ongoing. I hope not, but like I get momentum, and I'm like, all right, we're back. And then something will come up where I'm like, man, it's just – I've talked with other people recently, and they've been like, yeah, I'm kind of have the same thing going in my life. You know, when you're just, things are going smoothly, it's not necessarily the flow state, but just like there are other times in life where it's just kind of a molasses thing of like,
yeah.
And so it's been a bit of that for the last however many months or a couple of years now, but I think it's looking up.
Mercury in retrograde or whatever. I kept saying that with my wife because, like, yeah, weird things kept happening. But like, I think Mercury is still in retrograde. Probably it's never been, but like, it's just a good way to.
Yeah, that's a funny way.
Something else.
I'll do that too. Yeah, well, hopefully Mercury's moving. Maybe this eclipse that just happened will.
Exactly.
Or is happening right now. Maybe that'll shake things up a bit. But thanks again. Always great catching up. Really, always enjoyed chatting with you. Interesting.
Yeah, and, this was awesome.
Yeah. Well, thanks again. Well, again, I think you're probably back here for music, because if you're a Patreon subscriber and you make this show possible, ad-free, it is made possible by contributions from listeners just like you. So you've clearly tuned in at this point because you want to hear some music. That's a kind of a reach. I don't like to think that I'm using the music as some sort of lure or incentive or token or something like that. More so, I try to find music that is a little less common, maybe, and shine a little light on it so that they get a little exposure. Maybe it'll help their career. So that's why you don't hear a ton of really popular music. Partly too, I could get into a whole thing there, but it'll get like flagged by Spotify. So Spotify can recognize copyrighted material, take down a whole podcast episode, but cannot pay you for putting your material out there as a comedian, as whatever, 0.03 cents per play or something like that. I mean, good Lord. So I hope when they do flag an episode that includes, you know, someone large, like a well-known artist, that they are just saying, hey, we can't risk having to parcel out this 0.03 cents for you to include that in your podcast. Too tough for us. So you might notice in the catalog, maybe some of the episodes, I think I've really only been notified once that has happened. Hey, it's Spotify. This episode is going to get taken down because there's some copyrighted material, to which I feel like, fine. I don't put intercepts on Spotify. I just don't enjoy the way they conduct themselves as a business. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they've been great to a lot of people, a lot of exposure. But I could go into a whole thing about how they took down a bunch of artists who were engaged in I think I talked about that in a Patreon. So I will skip that. Not the time or place here. Just had a great chat with Yoichi Shiga. Great to catch up. We didn't even really get into what he does with the bank, only knowing that I'm glad he's there. I feel like when you have someone who's conscientious, mindful of how they approach life, of what they commit their energy and time to, you want people like that in a place where sometimes, and maybe this is stereotypical, but people in those buildings can get a little carried away with upgrading their yacht or their jet and a little less mindful of the implications that might trickle down or relay to other people involved in their enterprise. So glad Yoichi's there, and maybe he'll make some good in the world as far as sustainability and people being a little more conscientious of how their actions and their business impact the planet. I think if you listen to this show, it's something that comes up as a recurring theme pretty constantly. And I hope you feel engaged by that as opposed to like, ugh, more of this. Just let me buy my cheap plastic garbage. I got to decorate my yard with something. I don't imagine that's how you sound if you listen to this show. I don't hear from everybody all that much. So in my head, I just have this sort of made up listener base. And they're great. Just wonderful people. Introverts, rarely reaching out. I can identify with that. So thank you for listening from afar. But again, if you do have suggestions, feedback, even criticisms, I can take it. More so, I'd love to hear from you if you have music, guests, topics, subjects, articles, recent developments, scientific breakthroughs, types of beer, maybe something you'd like to see consumed on the show and talked about. We can do that. Anyway, let's get out of here. Hello to our friend Dan down under. Just moved recently. Haven't brought him up recently, but hello. Maybe we'll get him back editing some episodes together because we haven't done that in a while. It's very nice to dedicate and donate his time. And maybe as I'm falling behind so much here, maybe Dan could help that. I feel like in the past it added another element. I'm really rambling. Sorry. Going from like, well, I can just do this myself, or do you ship something off and then the person, Dan's really quick of turning around. Here you go. So maybe I need to do that again. Anyway, hello to Dan. Hope the new place is going well. Thanks again to Yoichi. This is a song that Yoichi shared. I won't say anything positive or negative about it, but I will say that it's nice to have someone else contribute to the show and offer some music. He said, hey, I should find the exact quote because he said something to the effect of it has some pep. Here's one that I discovered right before the pandemic that's got a nice pep to it. So if you need a little pep in your life, you certainly do from time to time. Here it comes. This is by Heartbones. It's called This Time It's Different. Yoichi and I hope you like it. Thanks for stopping by the Space Cave.
This time it's different.